So at that point, because it's experimental and there's very little knowledge, you're gonna crash, and you have to crash because that's how you get better.
Yo, is that your drone to your left?
Yes, that's actually an interesting story. It's like an earlier version. This aircraft was meant to fly. And because it's all 3D printed, we do modification at every single iteration of the aircraft. And that does mean sometimes we get it wrong. And so we did a modification, didn't realize we moved the wing, not wanting to do it. And by the time we assembled it, we're like, this plane's never going to fly. So let's just turn it into a cool piece. But this is actually like all manufactured to be a flyable aircraft. We just know if we were to fly it, it would just like fly upside down. And it wouldn't work. So,
that is so cool.
It's not just a demo aircraft.
Is it possible, like, if I have an aircraft where the right wing is this high and the left wing is this high, can that fly? Can you compensate for that some way?
Yeah, I think it would not actually be a problem. There are aircraft that actually are asymmetric. So you have some plane that would have the left wing would be forward of, like, let's say the center of the aircraft, and the right wing would be behind. You can actually, like, these are like planes that were experimental, but like it's all public. You can find the images. So there are things that look way wackier than just one being slightly lower than the other. You have some literally where it's, asymmetric.
That is crazy. What was your favorite subject in school?
I think physics. I think it was biology. I think I was best in biology for whatever reason, even though that's not what I did at all. But I really liked physics. I have a clear memory of... like one day where there was like, in high school level kind of physics where I was like, oh, we're going to model that piece of, snow that is going to slide from the top of the roof. And then it reaches the end of the roof. What is the speed that it reaches? And then, how far does it fall down from the wall? It's fairly basic. But I do remember thinking, wow, that's so cool. They can predict this. And I think from there, like, I was like, oh, physics is really cool.
Exactly. So, right. You say it's fairly basic, but like, there's a lot of things at play with the snow, right? So we're talking about like, friction, right? How big is it? Mm-hmm. How much friction is there on the snow? Also, too, like if you wanted to get really technical, how packed down is the snow? Because here's the thing, like very loose snow equates to tons of friction, right? But like very packed down snow is essentially less friction than actually rolling down a hill because it's slick. So like there is lots of variables like that, but it is, I totally agree. It is really cool to say, hey, I'm dropping this bowling ball from the roof. And you can use math right now to tell me how long it's going to fall.
Yeah, exactly.
That's brilliant.
So I think, what was your favorite topic at school?
Math. Listen, Matt, you're touching a touchy subject. Listen, I was so bad in school. I graduated with very, very low grades because I was more interested in getting pretty girls and trying to party. One subject that I did like, regardless of anything, was math. It was interesting because I was, I made D's and F's. I made very low grades, but I was in an advanced math class, like for gifted students. It was so interesting because all of my other gifted students in the math classes would make A's. They would make straight A's in all the other classes, but I would make an A in math, but an F in everything else. So I just really like math. It just kind of clicked for me. Like it's like, okay, there's a way to solve this. I have some tools in my tool bag, right? Different ways to approach these formulas. And it's up to me to choose the right one. And that really like inspired me and really like stimulated my brain.
I can relate to this. I guess like that's what I liked about physics is it made it more tangible than math because math can be like, it is very abstract. So it's kind of, yes. I mean, physics is just like the real world implementation of mathematics. So that's what I liked, I think.
Do you know who is considered like the birth person of physics?
No.
Who invented it?
I
think they had to be on some drugs, right? Because could you imagine in like the year 1500 and, you're just sitting there and you're like, wow, that apple fell from a tree. I wonder if it falls the same speed every time. And I wonder if I can predict that.
Yeah. It's hard to try to relate to those times when, I mean, everything we do today, you always stand on the shoulders of whatever had like the people before you who built previous stuff. And we would be completely incompetent, the two of us, if we were brought back to those times, right? I don't know what we would do. It's like, our skill set would be pretty useless, right? So it's hard to imagine how you come up with those formulas to start with. Maybe drugs, as you said,
or alcohol, whatever. But it's more so like the intuition of like, why are you curious about this? I think like, especially back then, there was a lot of things going on. There was a lot of sicknesses. We didn't know like a lot of stuff about health, biology. We didn't know a lot of stuff about a lot of stuff. But some guy or gal was like, I wonder if all of these objects are in relation to one another in some way. And I wonder if I could predict that. Like that, that is, I don't know who that person is, but I wish I did, because like you said, we're standing on their shoulders right now. I want to chat. So in 1986, you're probably familiar with this, here in the United States, we had the Challenger space shuttle that blew up and killed everybody on board. One of the engineers that worked on the Challenger space shuttle, on his way to watch the launch, leaned over to his daughter and said, the Challenger is going to blow up and everybody is going to die. That's exactly what happened. Now, with hindsight, we know that the engineering teams were screaming from the rooftop saying, do not put people on this space shuttle. Don't do it. Don't do it. It's not ready for showtime. But yet, management, whatever you want to call it, intervened and said, you know what? We don't care. We're still going to do it. I work with computers as my day job, software engineer, programmer, whatever you want to call it. So I've been on some of these engineering teams, and I've seen like the dynamic where engineering and management a lot of times are butting heads. Not like bad, but for example, I've never been on an engineering team where we released a product and every single engineer was like, yep, that's it. It's ready for showtime, right? We go to lunch and we're like, I cannot believe this. Listen, we're going to get hacked. This doesn't work. We're going to lose users. The company is going to go under, right? Because we're engineers, right? We get paid to perfect stuff. We find flaws and we can't sleep until those flaws are fixed. But management steps in and says, hey, you know what? We need to make some money. Maybe the product isn't perfect, but let's release it anyways. Maybe it's good enough for our users. So you, previously being an engineer and now being a manager, how do you deal with that dynamic?
Well, first, I'm still very much an engineer because I'm still the architect of the product. So I'm still very much like hands-on, and my background is, aircraft design. So that's, I would say I'm kind of like having to account for both sides, but, how do I handle that dynamic? Well, I think it's what's interesting when you talk about like NASA and the space shuttle, it was very much experimental. I mean, by definition, there weren't that many shuttles and that many flights. So it's, and also, I mean, NASA was not like made for like commercial gain, right? It was, So the dynamic of how do you get to, it's not like there's a financial incentive that managers are like, oh, we need to work for the bottom line or whatever. It was, maybe there was like, whatever the budget is constrained and we need to hit that milestone. Otherwise the project's going to shut down or whatever. I'm not too sure what happened exactly. I mean, from what I know on that specific flight was like some issues with seals that were not designed for the right flight condition or something. I can't remember the exact detail, but so I don't know how this translates to like as a startup where, yeah, sure, you have to get to like some eventual economical benefit to what your solution is. At some point, yeah, you might have to like, as a manager, like weigh between like technical readiness and releasing a product. It's an interesting question.
Do you feel
as a startup?
Do you feel your product right now is like technically complete? Like, is there like a to-do list?
No.
Okay, yeah, there we go.
Not at all. I mean, but that's not even our product. That's just the industry. Like, the safest mode of transportation on the planet is to get onto an airliner. It's like by far the safest. The reason it's that safe is because any plane you get on board of today, basically the same from like maybe 70 years ago. Like the first plane that had the configuration that planes have today, you know, like a fuselage with a swept wing and like engines hanging below it. It almost, if you look at planes today, you just think that's what a plane is like, but that's not what a plane is like. That's just that specific implementation of a plane is like that. And all airliners have that exact same design, which means the reason it's safe today is because we have so much cumulative experience of flying exactly that plane. I mean, sure, there's been, you know, small improvements and things, but I mean, the improvement in planes today in like airliners, I think it's like 0.3% per year, like the improvement in fuel efficiency or something. So basically nothing's happening. So that it's so safe because there are so many of those experiments, and cumulatively, every time, you know, there's a fuck up and something blows up, then you fix it and it never happens again. And then progressively you just become so safe because you've covered every single possible thing that could ever happen, right? But when you're in a new industry like drones, where, you know, we've designed this concept, someone is going to design another concept, nobody has any experience in any of those concepts, it's electric, there isn't much history of building electric planes, you basically restart from scratch. So none of the knowledge from before, I mean, physics, you know, it's still the same, but like the knowledge of the specific aircraft concept, like, is not transferable. You need to redo everything. So at that point, because it's experimental and there's very little knowledge, you're going to crash and you have to crash because that's how you get better, because you crash and then you're like, okay, well, let's fix this problem that we didn't know existed, and then it never breaks again. And if you do it properly, and then you get to the next one and the next one and the next one until ultimately you fix like all of the one required to have like a plane that is like super reliable. And nobody in the industry has gotten to that stage yet. So if you look at like the most reliable drone probably on the planet, is going to be something from, like say, probably Boeing. There's like a drone called the Scan Eagle, which has been in service since like the year 2005. Wow. It's flown like probably millions of hours by now. And an individual drone like this, which is like a 25 kilo, 3 meter span drone, so relatively big, an individual drone lasts for 500 to 600 hours, like the estimate. And that's nothing. Like, it's not really, you wouldn't get on a plane that has, most likely is going to crash in the next 500 hours, right? So to when you say, is the product finished? If you mean finished as it's as reliable and as safe as like a regular plane, like the industry is miles away from that. And our specific iteration, because we're more novel and pushing boundaries a bit more, we're also on the slightly lower end of like the reliability. So there's plenty of stuff that we need to figure out. And so, yeah, every day when we go flying, there's always a question of, amongst the things that we're testing as part of this flight, are we comfortable with the risk? And for us, most of the time, because we do maritime monitoring with our drones, so we fly above water, very easy to mitigate the risk because you basically aren't going to crash on anyone. And the air traffic also is, like, there's no air traffic low level above water. So it's the safest environment. That's one of the reasons we actually do mostly operation above water, is because it's much safer of an environment to do all these tests. So definitely it's not sorted, and we have to deal pretty frequently with like what's the risk of crashing and are we comfortable with it?
So what metric do you use to measure success? You were saying that Boeing's drone, it's how many air hours you can do before it kaputs, before it goes out. Is that what you're striving to do with your drone, is to increase the air hours, or do you use a different metric?
We actually do use very different metrics, and I think that's probably one of the things that is most interesting about what we do. Because figuring out, when you have a new industry and you don't know yet what's going to be most impactful with, you know, unmanned aircraft, like inevitably when we have millions of them flying around, it's hard to know in advance exactly what's going to be the most impactful outcome. Figuring out, like taking a bet on what we think that's going to be, and like figuring out the metric that would be important for that use case is probably what matters the most if you want to be like really relevant in the future. And it's a bit like, I like the example of, not for drones, but an equivalent industry that had to go multiple times figuring out what that metric was, is the hard drive industry. You're in software, but it's like, I don't know, there might be some people in your audience that don't even know before SSDs in some way, but it's like you had like very large disks, and then the generation after it was like a slightly smaller one. And every time the trade-off was like, oh, do I want the smaller one that will be more reliable? Like I don't have to carry my laptop being careful because otherwise I'm going to damage the disk. And you know, you had, I don't know, you probably remember, but like you had those iterations, right? Yeah. And every time a company was a leader in one of, in like the established size of hard drive, they were like, oh, we're just going to keep making it as cheap as possible per unit storage, because that's what people care about. They want just more storage. And that's true. And you had those other companies that were, oh, we're going to do the smaller one that is way more expensive, but we're betting that one day people will not care that much about how cheap it is per unit storage. They will care way more about, you know, it's more compact, consumes less energy, whatever. And what happened is, this actually happened multiple times. And every time the company that was the leader in one domain just disappeared, before the next one that replaced it ultimately. And so it's kind of like, people really struggle to see what is the metric that matters in your industry. And every time these guys were getting it wrong, and they were just focusing so much on like long term is dollar per gigabyte or whatever. And every time, it's always true, but there is a time when people stop caring and they care more about like a smaller disk or faster or whatever. And so for drones, I think there is an equivalent, which is right now people care about like endurance, because the first drones were all in the defense space. And the main use case for defense is how long can you, you know, you take off and how long can you stay above that enemy position and keep me giving me intel? If you can stay 24 hours, that's fantastic. You know, I don't have to think about it. It's just always there. But if you're talking about like an industrial use case or a use case where you want to, you know, survey an area, it almost doesn't matter like how long it takes. You actually want something that goes very quickly, right? It's like a bit for when you get on the plane to go somewhere, you're not buying flight hours on the plane. You actually want the least amount of flight hours, right? You just want to get to the location. And the metric in that case is range or your speed, because that's what's going to get you the most utility. And people don't look at that for drones. They just look at, again, endurance, like how long can you stay in the air and give me information. We don't look at all about endurance. We just look about, actually, the end thing for us is dollar per square kilometer, which sounds obvious, is like the metric for how much data you're going to be collecting at what cost. And for that, it means you want a plane that flies fast, so you do lots of kilometer per hour, and a plane that collects data with a sensor very far either side. So you can imagine it's kilometer that way, and then kilometer per hour that way, that's square kilometer per hour, so you do high data collection, right? And then reduce the cost of the flying of the drone, and then you get your dollar per square kilometer. And that's our metric, like the top level. That's the only thing we care about, really.
So if you could snap your fingers and 10x one aspect of your drone, like in order to crush your KPA, like what the thing that you're solutioning for, what would it be? It sounds like it would either be more batteries or better sensors, right? I know with the batteries there is like a weight issue and stuff like that, but like, because I'm guessing that you do spend engineering hours on like fixing stuff that is going to have the biggest impact. So like, what is that component on the drone that if improved would have the biggest impact?
It's neither of them actually. The one that will have the biggest impact is actually happening next year. And that is solving the connectivity issue to drones. Because right now when you fly a drone, the only accepted mean is direct communication to the drone from your ground equipment to like the aircraft. The reason for it is, one, I mean, sure, you can have 4G in some locations, but it's not that reliable enough. So often regulators don't accept 4G as like a primary mean of control because you might lose it. It's hard to predict. You know, maybe sometime you lose signal on your phone. It's okay. But if it's a drone and you lose signal, that's pretty bad. So 4G is not really used that. It's not really accepted because of this. So it's always direct line of sight. And the issue with this is you have really strong constraints on what frequencies you can use and how powerful the signal is allowed to be, which completely legitimate, you know, like so you don't want to like completely fill the electromagnetic spectrum with everyone emitting stuff, right? So it's very constrained. And the regulation are different per countries. So when you're someone like us who go and fly maritime monitoring mission with drone in different countries, you have to constantly change your thing. You have to get new permits for like just, and you're just talking wireless transmission at that point. It's very painful. So this would be the one thing that I wish was different. And it actually is going to be different probably from this year or next year with Starlink. Because pretty soon it's just, I don't know if you've seen, but Starlink, they now are doing direct to cell. So you don't even need like their antenna and their stuff, like literally on your cell phone. Like they did some demos where I think they were getting 17 megabits per second. So what they said is this year they're going to do text direct to phone. So I guess you get a mobile phone subscription to Starlink. And then from next year, it's going to be data. And for us, that's a massive breakthrough because we can just use a 4G chip that doesn't connect to the local network, just connect directly to Starlink. It's very reliable across the planet. You get it anywhere. You don't need to adapt your communication system. You don't need to travel with an antenna that is connected to your system and talks to the drone. Just the drones go and you don't need to worry about wireless transmission. That's going to be a big breakthrough for the whole industry. It's going to make everything so much simpler because you won't have to worry about transmission anymore. It's just, you know, the thing flies, it gets data and you don't have to worry about it. It's going to be great.
That is beautiful. So currently, what happens if, let's say you're flying your drone in a remote location and you lose cell coverage? Does it crash or does it have some type of fallback?
So we actually don't use cell. We use, because as we fly mostly above water, it's you actually get really good 4G signal quite far out, but not everywhere, and it's hard to know in advance. So we don't use 4G. We use direct line of sight communication. So we have basically a transmitter receiver on the ground from where the pilots are operating the drone from. And we have another one on the drone. So it's like bi-directional communication. The drone sends telemetry about, you know, its speed or status of its battery, whatever, gets to the ground. And we do the same data the other way around. We're sending commands, you know, go this that direction. Here's the new mission plan or whatever. So we have one channel that's called telemetry for doing that. And that is on one specific frequency and power that tends to be like very long range. So this one is pretty easy to sort out. And also it's very low bandwidth because you're, you know, you're just sending like strings of text, like really. The way the other one that we need is video to transmit the data from the payload on the aircraft. So video or images. And this one, so it's only one way, it comes down from the drone. This is much more constricted for bandwidth. Like we need a lot more. That's also on a higher frequency, so it tends to be lower, shorter range, but it's also direct line of sight. So again, transmitter on the ground, talks to the plane on the way back. And this typically goes on top of a mast because when you fly quite far, you actually need to have quite a high-level antenna to be able to reach the drone. So yeah, that's a lot of equipment. That's why it's so much better. It would be so much better if we had Starlink.
Yeah, no. So what about...
Oh.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I actually didn't answer your question. You said, like, what happens if one of these things fails? So I just explained to you why we don't use 4G, that what we use right now. If we lose connection, I said we have one pipe basically for command and control of the aircraft and another one for video. The one for video can actually be used for command and control as well. So it's kind of a redundancy. If we lose the main one for command and control, then we can still use the one that is used for video as command and control. So we have some about redundancy there. But if we lose both, the aircraft knows that it's lost the communication to the ground station. And so it's programmed to just come back at that point. And it has really specific location that it's meant to come back to if it loses the signal. So you plan these in advance. And typically, as soon as you start flying back, because you get closer, you get back the signal. So it's pretty, like you would just lose the signal, it flies back, and maybe you wait a minute and then you have your signal back. And all of this, you design it so that no matter what happens, it remains safe because you know exactly what procedure the drone will go through and it's not going to overfly a city or whatever. So yeah, that's how we handle having issues with communication.
That's absolutely brilliant. I wish I was a software engineer over there. That sounds so cool, man. It's like, right, so you're right. Like this is such a great challenge. It's like, okay, because I kind of worked on a project that was somewhat similar. Like we used to deploy sensors in like really remote places. And, you know, sometimes we would lose signal and we had to have like these type of redundancies. That's why I asked you, but that's so cool. It's like, okay, hey, we lost signal. Okay. We need to turn, don't turn too sharp or, you know, there's aerodynamics and stuff like that. You need to come back to this waypoint, all of that stuff. That is awesome, man. That is so cool. Do you ever think like one day that your drones will be able to fly fully autonomously, or does that not provide any benefit at all to your industry?
Oh, I mean, 100% for sure. It will, without a doubt, at some point be fully autonomous, and it will be very different from what it is today. So maybe I'll explain just briefly how it works today, because some people might have a misconception. But so most drones are now like fully automated, not autonomous. So automated, which means you can just write the mission. So, you know, like for you, like software engineer, you could just write a text file that says, you know, here are the coordinates and the time I want you to be there, and the drone will just go and do it and with no supervision. But it will also do that in such like as like blindly. He will assume nothing is there. And if there was something between like where it has to go and where the drone is now, I'd just crash into it. Like unless it's terrain. Like, I mean, but it's mostly automated. It does that automated job very well. Like the drone can fly itself and handle changing weather, changing wind, whatever, like no problem. There are two difficulties. One is for all of that flight, you still need human supervision just from a regulatory standpoint. And often that regulatory supervision needs to be very close to the drone to make sure the drone doesn't crash into someone else, like another plane or something. Often it's 500 meters. So that means you need someone within 500 meters of the drone, which is, like, completely breaks the whole concept, right? Because either you don't fly the drone far or you need someone every 500 meters, which again completely defeats the point. So that's the limitation number one today. And the second one is actually let's imagine like the second one is the ground handling. So like imagine when you land with an airplane on an airport, you have tons of people that are there, like, you know, hooking up the plane, like unloading the luggage, refueling, whatever. It's the same for the drone. You need to like pull out the battery. Maybe there's like some maintenance you need to do. So you still need people on the ground to do that stuff as well, on top of the flying. So those two constraints kind of right now, they work well together because you need a pilot to be there from a regulatory standpoint, and you need that pilot to be there anyway because some work needs to be done on the drone. But inevitably in the future, probably pretty soon, you're going to have better regulation. So you don't need the 500 meter person at all time away from the drone, because there would be, you know, an air traffic management that makes sure the drones don't crash into each other. Then other airplane users are safe as well. That's like, that's going to happen for sure. But then at that point, the big problem will be, how do you automate the ground handling and everything? Because you don't want to have fully autonomous drones, but then every time when it lands, you need someone to swap the batteries, right? So you will need an infrastructure of kind of like robotic airports or something. But these two things will happen for sure. And then when they do, drones will be a lot more like, I mean, let's, if today they're like today you go somewhere with your drone, you fly it, you pack it back and you go back to your location. That's typically how it is. It's like very bespoke if you want to collect data with a drone. In the future, it's going to be a lot more like satellites, where if you want, you know, today, like we could log in on a website. If you wanted to buy satellite imagery from somewhere, you're not going to buy your own satellite and then go to a location and then launch your satellite and collect the data, right? That's what it used to be a long time ago. A long time ago, if you wanted satellite imagery, you had to buy your own satellite, put it in space, wait a few years, and then you could get your data. Drones are like that today. But in the future, again, it's going to be like satellite today, where there's going to be just an infrastructure of drones. So some form of robotic airports, like hangars, from which drones take off and land all the time. You don't really see them. You don't really think about them. And the only way you interact with these drones will be through web interfaces, where you could just log in and say, okay, I want data in 5 minutes. I want data over there. Every 20 minutes, I want an update, please. And then you just get that data. I think that's how it will be. So at that point, it's just complete automation. And the only interface is through the through that web interface.
Why would we need like a network of drones kind of like hovering above us if we already have a network of satellites doing that exact same thing?
Well, that's a good question, and I think you'll need both. So the issue with satellites, and again, that's like, I think with movies we get a misconception of how powerful satellites are. So the first thing with satellites, most constellation are like maybe two or three satellites, and you don't have any control of where the satellite is at any one point. Like, you can't like steer it or slow it down, or like, you know, it's going to go around at a very predictable rate. And if you want data somewhere on the planet, you can't say, I want it at that time tomorrow. You're just going to get told, oh, you can get it tomorrow at that time or the day after at that time. So and let's say you live in wherever, it's just going to be, I can only get data maybe every 2 days, maybe every day at 3 p.m. If you want any data any other time, it's not going to work. So first, that's kind of limited, right? That data is good enough if you want to do maybe a map of an overall region, but if you're trying to track whether there's a wildfire, you got one update this morning, you're not getting another one until tomorrow. That's kind of a problem. The second thing is you're dependent on weather. So if there's cloud coverage, for example, and you're talking optical sensors, then you're not getting coverage. There are other sensors that see through clouds, but then they have limitation on like like synthetic aperture radar, for example. You can see through clouds, but it's very different resolution. It's much lower. So that's like those two problems. And then ultimately, yes, you do have a resolution problem, because you're not going to get as good data, as if you're flying in the atmosphere with a small drone. So for example, with satellite, you're not going to get to reading, like, I don't know, on the side of a vessel, what is the registration of that vessel? Or you're not going to be able to see, are the people on the vessel currently, what type of fishing are they doing? Is it just a vessel, or is it a vessel that is fishing right now? And these things are important when you're trying to enforce, for example, a maritime protected area. You want to know these things, and satellite are not going to be able to give you that.
Yeah.
And that's true even if you're talking nano satellites or CubeSats, because these ones, sure, you can do a lot larger volume. So you solve some of the problems of like revisits. So, you know, you don't have potentially to wait until tomorrow, same time. You could just probably get it in 20 minutes. But then because these are smaller, you get smaller sensors that don't have the good optical quality to be able to see like crazy high magnification levels. So broadly, that does mean that even if you look at trends into the future, lower launch costs, drones are still going to be much better if you want to do like very high revisit rates. So, you know, get the data like every 5 minutes or real time. Mm-hmm. If you want to do high resolution, if you want to be independent to weather, if you want like critical response to things like a fire or whatever, like drones are going to be much better to this. But, and also satellites is very expensive, like crazy expensive if you want to buy data, which again, like we, you don't think about it, it this way when you see movies and things, but it's like $20 to $30 per square kilometer, which doesn't sound like much, but if you want to do a large area, but also if you want it, like let's say you want it every 5 minutes on updates, then it gets crazy expensive. We constantly talk to people that tell us like we can't use satellite, it's just too expensive. So
So it sounds like, doesn't it sound like your vision of the future that you just described, which is like pretty cool. I've never heard anybody with this idea where we just have like a network of drones flying and you can tune in like to a website, a live stream of like a drone to see like, hey, I want to see what Sweden is looking like today. I want to see what China's looking like. Isn't that vision of the future contradicting your design of the drone? Because you said that one of the things you're not solving for is airtime. You're like, hey, listen, you know, like airtime is cool, but that's kind of not our thing. So are you concerned about not being part of your future?
That's a really good point. That's a good way to put it. So there's, I guess, there's two elements to this. One is a bit, you know, when I said that there are different technology, like for hard drive, as the dollar per kilobytes or something was getting lower, at some point people stopped caring and they started caring about like a smaller drive, which was more expensive, but at that point it was so cheap anyway, the dollar per kilobyte, so that they were moving and to that next tech stack, and it happened multiple times. I think for drones it might end up being the same thing, where right now, sure, people will, for some use cases, people that where they want high endurance, they might not use our drone, but by the time all of that stuff is implemented, batteries will be better, and at that point a drone that maybe today fly for 5 hours, in the future will fly for 10 hours, and then people won't care about flying 10 hours. Ours will fly 5 hours, but it will be like 3 times faster than the other one, so we'll collect way more data and you'll get the data faster. So there is that one aspect. The other one that I think is even way more important, actually, is the issue in airplane design is, I mean, in some way, it's very easy to get more endurance. It's like, it's simple. You just make a bigger plane. It's not like you're being like a better physics or whatever. It's literally bigger aircraft that has bigger fuel tanks or better, more batteries, and then you get more performance. The downside of this is because it's bigger, it's way more expensive. And so there is a real question always in aerospace stuff is like, you want to tailor what you're building to the use case you're serving. What that means is, for example, if you fly short range flights, in the US or in Europe, you're going to have the smaller aircraft that is tailored to do like, you know, between two small cities. And also it's just designed to do those missions, not like something much bigger. The bigger aircraft that are designed for the longer range, you don't use them on those small flights. It's kind of like, you know, you wouldn't go on a 747 to fly between, I don't know, I'm not going to pick a city pair in the US because I mean, my US geography is not great, but like, I don't know, you wouldn't be a 747 to go between New York and Washington, DC or something. That'd be stupid. I don't even know if there are flights between the two pairs. So. And so for us, we've done those drones that are smaller, higher speed, longer, smaller endurance, because we think for a lot of use cases, you don't care about spending 12 hours in the air. You might occasionally want to do a very long range flight where it's important, a bit like a 747, but for most of our flight, you should be doing the smaller one. So we're building the small aircraft that is used for short range flights. If we're doing in a comparison to air travel, we're not beginning the bigger one because most of the time you just want, for the short mission, just use the smaller one. It's better. So it's kind of like those two things.
Okay. This is great. So not only are you a great technical person, but you're a good CEO. So it sounds like you're saying, hey, look, in the future, there's going to be drones that's like up there for 12, 14, you know, 48 hours, depending on how good batteries and technology gets. Say, look, I'm not trying to compete with those guys, is what you're saying. Saying, look, I think that there's going to be a great use case for a different type of drone, and I'm going to build that drone. And listen, Boeing, the big guys, they can fight over there, but you're a small, scrappy startup. You're saying, look, we're going to corner this area of the market and just focus on that.
Yeah, 100%. Actually, maybe a good example is, I don't know if you've heard, like in the UK, but like between... So we're based in the UK, but I'm French. I've been in the UK for 12 years. So between the UK and France, there's quite a lot of like illegal vessels crossing. It's like 125 people a day on average. And at the size of the UK, it's probably not the biggest problem, but it is like a super political thing. And with the government that is in place at the minute, it's like part of their electorate care about like illegal immigration. And so they're spending tons of money on solving this. And the way they're doing it is they're spending actually a lot of money on drones to monitor the area. So you have to picture this area between France and the UK. It's like 30 kilometer wide. It's really small. And they're flying a drone that flies for maybe 12 to 18 hours. So it's like a 150 kilos, two engine internal combustion. So like, you know, this is 10 kilos, like completely different, the drone they're using. And the headline figure for that contract is $300 million a year to fly that one drone. That drone flies for 12 hours. But what it does is it does like, it basically does like a loop that we could do with our drone probably in like an hour. It does that one loop in 12 hours, and it just occasionally does like circles when it sees like a vessel or whatever. And you could imagine, like, that's a completely stupid use of a drone of that capacity. You'd be much better off with just like, you know, five or six much smaller one. You just send one to do the full loop in 1 hour. And then if you find something, just dispatch another one to spend like an hour looking at whatever vessel you find. And yeah, the reason people do this in the UK is because they buy on the headline number of like, you know, you can fly for 12 hours and maybe it's from like a big company. So it's like reputable. But the consistently, like, people look at those problems and they don't break it down as a scientist would to think, you know, what is actually needed and what's the best solution. They just look at headline number that historically have been the one that have been important for like surveillance drones. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how us trying to focus on other smaller niche markets where basically what we do is we go after the market that can't afford those $300 million a year that I've just talked about that the UK spends. Yeah. And then we go there where they can't afford that and we say, look, we have something that is much cheaper and they like the fact that it's much cheaper. They can't afford planes. They can't afford like those very expensive drones, but it can't afford us. But ultimately, they're going to end up with a better solution that the UK is spending like 100 times more. And the view is at some point they'll realize that and then we can go pick up those businesses as well. Yeah.
Well, how do you tackle that? Because it sounds like your sales pitch is highly technical, which it is how I think as well. It's like, hey, let's break it down from first principles, right? It's like, hey, we have a problem. Is it a problem? What's the best way to tackle this problem? Let's lay out five solutions and let's like make a decision based on pros and cons, technical trade-offs, cost, all of these things. It sounds like that is your sales pitch, but a lot of times it's really hard to get non-technical people or governments or stuff like that to buy into that. So how, like, how do you sales pitch like a politician or something like that from a technical standpoint, saying that I have the better solution?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Do you take them to dinner, get them a glass of wine, maybe tell them they're pretty? Is that how you do it?
I think that's how the big companies do it. For sure. In defense, like it's all like relationship driven and, that's probably, yeah, you get people to dinner or you already know them anyway. I think for us, it's, again, like whatever answer is definitely work in progress because that's not easy to figure out on exactly what's the best way to do it. I think it's like
do you have to play the game of the big companies, right? That's the question, right? Do you have to play the, hey, I need to schmooze politicians, I need to donate to their political campaigns, I need to know the right people, right? Is this because like it's work for them, right? They're getting a $300 million contract. Do you feel like that you have to play in that ball field, or are you going to try to approach it differently?
I think at our stage, we're not there yet. So, there's probably, for sure, we need to get to know the right people, but we're not at the stage and budget where we're going to do any donation or anything. And also, I think what we do is compelling enough that we probably don't need to do that yet. But like, so your question, how do we sell considering it's like highly technical? I think people are not going to buy the highly technical thing. Like it's interesting for me to explain what's different, because when you talk to people that are interested in the technical field, like it's exciting when you see, oh, this is a very different way to approach a problem. That's really cool. I hadn't thought of it. But yeah, they don't care about that in general. What works is when we've started doing demos now of like the actual fully integrated solution where like it's visually striking how it's different to how we're approaching things. So, for example, I haven't even mentioned this, but like the traditional way you collect data with a drone, drones actually don't really collect data in some way, like in surveillance traditionally. It's just you have a camera that, you know, like a gimbal camera. So you can rotate, you can tilt, whatever, and then it translates video back. You can zoom in and out. And that's remotely controlled by an operator. And so the data you get out of the drone is just that video imagery that you can store or whatever. But it's like, yeah, that's typically how it works. When we operated, we realized that actually that's a super ineffective way to monitor an area when you want to find boats. Because if you look, when we looked at tracks afterwards of our operators that were looking around with the camera, it was just a little bit there, a little bit there, and it was like not very systematic. So you were actually missing most of the area. Yeah. And people are not good. Like, why would you hire someone to just go left and right? Like, this is really ineffective. So instead, what we've built is a completely different sensor where you have cameras that are pointing just sideways. So you don't look forward or backwards. It's literally like five high resolution cameras with fixed focal length optics as well. Looks so much better. And exactly like a satellite, we just have that slit of imagery. And as we fly high speed forward, you just map in real time. So what we produce is a real time map of what's underneath. And that's very different, again, to just like a drone that flies and just sends you video of like what's happening over here and then afterwards over here. And now that we're starting to have that full system operational, we can go somewhere and give that image real time. And when you have someone from like, let's say, emergency services or like the military or whatever, and they have that interface that they can see the map being built in real time, it's kind of like, wow, okay, yeah, that now I understand. That's like, nobody cares about the technical details of how we do this. That's the compelling message. I think that's how we win people over, rather than like the technical pitch.
That is beautiful. And that is really, really cool if you can. So as it's flying, it's like it's beaming the data real time. And then you have like some website or some UI where it's like, mm-hmm. oh, wow, this is a map being built. It's real time. You know, I can check it out. That is a really compelling feature that I think would knock the socks off of most regular people.
Yeah. And the thing that gets exciting when you're talking to like people in the software space is that right now, you can imagine, like, it's much easier to build a startup just purely software, and AI is like the name of the game at the minute. So you have tons of people that are building software to do like AI analytics of drone data. But as I've just said, like, most drones collect like a video feed of a little bit here, a little bit there, and it's like, and they don't fly that often, they're unreliable. So you're kind of like starting to build, it's like if you were like YouTube and hadn't been invented and you were like building some AI tool and you need a training data set and there was just no video anywhere. Like, why would you do that at that stage? And it feels for drones, it's a little bit like this. So what I've just described now of like the data collection tool, like, I think it's pretty obvious that it's going to be much larger. It's built to collect way more data. And especially what we start with, which is above water, it's very easy to do computer vision on top and like pick up the boats automatically because it's not very difficult to spot a boat above water. So what I've just described, on top of being exciting for just like, you know, it's cool that the map builds itself as we fly, is that it's a perfect thing to do some AI feature on top afterwards. So, you know, detect the boats, label them, whatever, like, and then it's like you have a real-time view of exactly what's happening, and that's the next level afterwards.
Okay, I got it. Listen, I'll give you this one for free. You don't have to hire me. Yo, this is a great idea, because what you see a lot of, especially tech companies, specifically software companies, now all of a sudden their data sets are like one of the most valuable things they have. Like, it is mm-hmm. super valuable, more valuable than their employees, all of this. And because you're collecting so much more data, you can compile a data set that you can say, hey, look, yeah, we're a drone company, but yo, we have this data set that nobody else has, and it's at a resolution that nobody else has. And for example, you can fly over a certain segment of the Atlantic Ocean, just hypothetically. And you can do this every day, 100 days in a row. And then, like you said, you could take that data, and now you can train some very simple AI. This would be very easy to do, just to detect anomalies. It could be a ship, it could be a damn whale, right? Anything like this, right? But you have the data set, and you could say, hey, listen, government of the UK or whatever, I know you're interested in this 30-mile patch of water, but I can bet my life right now that nobody on Earth has more data on that patch of water than we do. And we have AI that will detect it. And so you don't need real humans. It's way cheaper. And our AI hit rate is like 98%. And so, yeah, it becomes like a no-brainer if you could compile this data set. Is that something that you're interested in?
Yeah, completely. And actually, in some ways, also like when you pitch to investor, I mean, that's obviously, they're very sensitive to those pitches, because it's like, it matches the existing patterns they have about what's going to be successful is like, you know, data sets and like software. What's it's harder to pitch, you know, building drones and like it scares people off often when you have hardware. So definitely that's a way to think about what we do as well. Like it's almost like we're doing that hard bit of building the drones and the infrastructure and getting the permits and all that stuff. And then that's like the defensible element that then gives us exclusive access to that data that nobody else can collect. And then that's like a compelling thing. The other thing that is interesting as well, and again, I'm going to make that comparison to satellite, is that the way drones work today is, again, like, let's say you're a company that manages container vessels that are leaving, like, you know, the Saint Laurent, like North Canada and like North America, So you're managing those vessels and you need very frequent imagery in that area because you need to know where the whales are so you don't hit it and hit the whales, and you comply with the required environmental protection. And also you can go faster because if you don't know where the whales are, you're going to go slowly. So currently you're flying planes all the time and it's very expensive. And maybe right now you've started using drones. And in that case, the way you would have used drones is you would have called the drone company. You would have said, okay, can you go in that area? And then they would say, okay, we're going to set up an operation for the next year. We're going to be there every day. And they will be flying drones just for your operation. So the data they collect will just go to you as a company that operates those vessels. And then you're going to solve the problem. You're going to know where the whales are. Fantastic. That looks a lot like satellites at the very beginning, where, again, you wanted data. You just had to put your own satellite in orbit and you would use the data you collected just for yourself. But satellites today don't work like that at all. You have the people that operate the satellite collect the data, and then they sell that same data to tons and tons of users.
Yeah.
And that's how it's much better. Like, it's a much better business, but also you can make it much cheaper because more people are depreciating the hardware. Drones are going to be this way as well, which gets back to what you were saying about the data and how it's interesting to think about that data. Is that, for, let's say you're the vessel operator and you called that company that said, okay, we'll come and fly our drones in the area and we'll charge you for the full year of all our expenditure because you're the only one using the data we're producing. Our view in the long term is we'll just have our system installed there. So we'll have robotic hangars where the drones are flying from. And we'll just say, yeah, okay, yeah, we're already flying there. We're selling the data to the Coast Guards. We're already selling the data to the people that are managing the fisheries in the area. Yeah, we can sell you the data. We already have it. And it's going to be like 10 times cheaper than whatever that other company quoted you. And you'll have it faster and whatever. So yeah, it's a completely different way to think about drones rather than someone you just hire and it will come with the aircraft. It's just going to be that data that everyone shares and can use the same data set, really.
I wonder if your drone, it seems like your drone would be perfect for some of these large container ships and other type of ships that go in these like hostile waters where there's pirates, right? Because it's so light. Like, couldn't you just have like you said, like a robotic hangar, right? And I'm on the boat, and then your drone launches, and it's like it can just scan the boat for, like, you know, hostile threats such as pirates and stuff like that, and do something about it. Like, have you ever thought about that use case, or am I watching too much TV?
No. Yeah, we do have renders for that use case. I think specifically is like insurance companies that would love to have like better understanding of how risky any situation is, so you can better price how you do your insurance. So there's definitely a use case there. It's just, a lot of what we've talked about is like long-term implementation of drones, like into the future. And when you talk about use cases, there's also to consider between where we are today and that long-term vision, what are the steps you're going to take to get there? And some use cases are going to be close to today, and then some use cases are going to be the very later stage one, right? So for example, where I said long-term, it's going to be that infrastructure of drones, everyone shares the data. When that's the case, that's when the data will be the lowest. So the people that have the least money will be able to get the full benefit of the technology at that stage. Today, you probably want to go after people that have a bit more money because you're not going to be yet able to have a full installation everywhere and everyone could get the data, right? Similarly, when you talk about operating from a vessel, that's kind of a high-risk environment because the vessel is moving constantly. There's probably a lot of risk if we were to crash. You know, do we damage the vessel and things? Also, you would need people on board the vessel that we need to maintain the aircraft. And that's a vessel that might be, I mean, it would be in dangerous waters by definition, based on like the use case you've talked about. So it's 100% something that will, I think for sure, at some point inevitably have a system like the one I've described, but it might not be the first one. For example, maybe an earlier one is going to be military vessels. So, you know, like the one of the biggest changes you had in Navy is when they started having helicopters on vessels, because it massively, like, it massively amplifies the capability of a vessel if you can have a helicopter on it that can extend the range of how much you can see around it. But most vessels can't have helicopters because they're too small. And in some way, like, you know, especially these days, you don't want really big vessels that are susceptible to like drone strikes and things. You want smaller vessels. So there is a lot of demand for like smaller military vessels where you could have drones on them. So that will, I think, happen before you have commercial application like the one you've talked about, like anti-piracy. I think before that, you might have smaller military vessels that don't have helicopters on right now that will have drones that can give you that surveillance capability around it, because they have a bit more money and they probably are exposed to more risks. So they're happy to like start implementing that technology first. But yeah, so would you had 100%.
No, yeah, like there's so many things just popping into my head on like how this can be used in like really cool ways. And one of them is like, I would just like to fly it. It seems like fun. But would you ever consider putting small weapons or explosives on the drone? Make it offensive.
I mean, we've definitely been asked because I think the design we have is like perfectly suited to it. Yes. So I didn't say, but this drone is, so it's fully 3D printed. It is printed in SLA, so it's like a plastic. And it's a plastic that is very not thermally conductive. So what that means is it's the heat that is generated by all the components just stays inside. So the aircraft has very little thermal signature. The aircraft is fully, again, plastic outside of the batteries inside. So in terms of radar signature, it's also pretty small. It's like much smaller than like a, you know, carbon fiber aircraft or something. And it's pretty small, you can see from the size, and it flies 100 miles per hour. So all of these things mean that it's actually very difficult to like see where is thermal sensors. It's really hard to see on radar. It's very hard to like see visually, also pretty silent because it's electric. So it fits like lots of boxes if you wanted to use for an offensive capability. And also because 3D printing and the size, they're really inexpensive compared to what drones in the military that size would cost like £200,000, and they're much, much cheaper for us to manufacture because of the choices we've made. So yeah, there's definitely an application. We've been asked about it. In general, that's not really something we're interested in. Because especially nowadays with all like more conflicts happening and it's way more polarizing. Like not everyone agrees on what's right, and you know, with different conflicts that are happening at the minute. So it's not something we're interested in. Like it's way more exciting, the vision I've talked about of like, how can you collect that data set at a large scale? How could you empower like, you know, civilian and military organization to know exactly what's happening at all time? And maybe you could have a much more unbiased view about like, you know, what are the events of this country doing stuff around here or stuff around here? And I think that's a more interesting thing for us to build.
Yeah. And I totally agree. I know it's really hard being a CEO. Like it is kind of a moral judgment. Like, can you sleep at night knowing that something you built may be killing civilians and stuff like that? But in the market, are what if you have a competitor that comes out and they do have weapons on it and they eat your lunch? Are you okay going bankrupt to that?
I don't think that would happen because there are plenty of companies in the drone space that are going after that at the minute. We don't really care because I think long-term that's not going to be the big market. I think people are going after this now because one is like bigger budget. So, you know, it's easier to make money. It's also like a big hype. So you have actually a lot more like of private capital going into funding stuff that is for defense. So it's very easy to go into this right now. But it's also very short-sighted because this is going to be quite cyclical. So yeah, it might be great for the next 5 years. It's probably going to go off afterwards. You're also very dependent on like politics and like whoever decides to buy your stuff. And also even longer term, like the trend in general has been that R&D is very outdated in defense. It's like the best stuff is not in defense, it's in commercial. If you look at satellites, sure, they started in defense, but like most of the expenditure now is like from commercial. So probably the biggest market long term are not going to be defense. So today it sounds exciting. So we're trying to do some R&D that is related to defense, which is like mostly like surveillance, providing the insights and everything. But I don't think there's a compelling use case to go heavily into defense and like offensive aspects outside of like short term profits and going down like a rabbit hole that really doesn't need too much in the future. So I think even from a purely business side of things, outside of like the ethical element, I don't think it's the right thing to do anyways.
Yeah, I agree. And it sounds like you make a compelling case that, hey, there's a market that doesn't require weapons and it's a big market and you can sustain your company times 10 with it. And you can also help people without, you know, blowing them up. Speaking of blowing up people, what do you think? So like, you're right, there's lots of conflicts going on around the world and stuff like that. Something as, you know, a technologist or whatever you want to call it, a nerd, myself, mm-hmm. I really don't quite understand why we still have boots on the ground fighting wars. The technology's out there. The technology's been out there for years to essentially like have like a drone warfare, right? Why would you ever, like a drone will beat a boots on the ground anytime. Me versus a drone, I stand no chance, right? Same thing like even against boats and stuff like this. I don't quite understand why we still have people with guns in hands whenever we can build powerful, cheap drones with weapons on them to fight these wars. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think that there are big issues with drones still today. So if you look in Ukraine, for example, where you constantly have both sides thinking, how can I defeat drones? Because drones have taken they have a massive role in the war now.
Yeah.
So everyone's trying to figure out how do you disable them? And there are plenty of very effective ways. And there's plenty of research now trying to counter that. So for example, drones the main source of data they rely on to know where they are and figure out what they need to do to get somewhere. It's all based on GPS. And it's pretty easy to jam GPS. So if it's pretty easy to jam, and you can actually jam GPS in such a way that it's not just the drone doesn't know where it is anymore. You actually make the drone believe that it's somewhere else. And wow. You can actually backwards fly the drone this way. So that means it's not just straightforward, like, oh, a drone works in your backyard when you're flying like a quadcopter. It's just going to work in a military airspace. It's not like there is this. There is also, you know, I talked about that line of sight communication stuff. Like, we're using like a radio transmission between the drone and the controller. Easy to jam as well, that stuff. Also, if you were to go to Ukraine and fly your quadcopter next to the front line, people would detect you're there because you're emitting signal. And so you'd get shot at. So it's not straightforward. And there's plenty of reason why it hasn't turned out like just to, you know, drones versus drones. Yeah, so that's probably one of the reasons. But I guess as well, like drones right now, like, I mean, maybe it's different when you're talking about Gaza, for example, where there's no really opposition. Like there aren't people that have on the ground like electronic warfare. Like so things to like jam GPS and things. I would assume it's probably quite limited. You're still constrained by like, you know, people are in buildings, so... you have to go into buildings. You can't really go with a drone, I guess. That would be the perspective. Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. I didn't know about the GPS jamming technology and some of the other stuff. So that kind of sucks because if we go into war, I am not trying to go in a trench with a gun. I would much rather it be like video games. Do you think one of your drones has been like mistaken for a UFO? Are you familiar with some of these weird like alien UFOs that are like often seen by pilots over like large bodies of water? They say that they go into the water and out of the water. Like, have you seen any of these with your drones? And if you have seen them, like, what would you do?
Oh, interesting. So I haven't heard of like the one you're talking about or like something coming in and out of the water. I mean, the stage at which we're at, it's not yet like we're not like scanning the whole planet every 5 minutes and knowing what's happening everywhere. Like, even though I think long term, whether it's us or like other manufacturers, like drones will eventually get to that. I'm pretty sure. So we're still deploying in a super limited fashion. So it's not like we've detected stuff. Like, nah, not at all.
Yeah.
But like, could a drone be mistaken for a UFO? I mean, probably. I mean, ours are pretty small and pretty fast, so you might. But they still look like planes. So
yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I'm for sure you could we could design something that looks like a UFO and behaves weirdly, and I'm pretty sure we could do that.
Could be and you should put like an alien face on it, paint it just to fuck with people. That would be awesome. I'm sure this is why I'm not the CEO and you are. Have you been keeping up with like some of the issues and the quality issues that Boeing is experiencing?
I mean, yeah, I've been seeing the news in the background. I haven't been looking into crazy amount of detail. I mean, my understanding is like, I used to work in Airbus. So, you know, like the main, antagonist, I guess. And
do you fly Boeing?
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah, you don't really have a choice anyway. Like you wouldn't go like discard some airlines based on like the planes they're flying. And also, I mean, when you're talking Boeing, like all the issues recently has been on specifically on the 737, right? And mostly like the most recent ones. So I think in Europe, we don't have that many 737s because those smaller aircraft, the equivalent from Airbus, the A320 is super popular in Europe. So you, outside of one or two airlines, you don't really get to on those planes. So I guess I don't have to ask myself the question that often. And on the bigger planes from Boeing, they've been flying for a very long time and I don't think there's been many issues. So, but yeah, I guess from what I understood, and it's an interesting thing, is it's like an overall company cultural issue.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that Boeing used to be a very much like engineering driven culture a long time ago. And the whole defense, because Boeing is partially a defense company, like that whole aerospace industry, the same in Europe, after World War II, when you had tons and tons of company over like, you know, the following decades, all of these companies ended up merging with each other and becoming those bigger groups. So, and Boeing in particular, I can't remember when exactly, but at some point they merged with McDonnell Douglas. And that company apparently at the time had a way more like a financially driven culture, when Boeing was very much engineering driven. And the way they did that merger, even though it just remained Boeing, like I don't even know if you know about McDonnell Douglas, but, the executive for McDonnell Douglas, took over a lot of the executive position in Boeing and took over that kind of like financially driven culture into Boeing. And I mean, you know, you can imagine in a large company like this, for cultural changes to be effective, it takes like decades. But I think what we're seeing now is like the result of that merger and how like it just changed Boeing from an engineering driven culture to a, you know, bottom line trying to optimize and make more money from existing planes.
What I said at the beginning, right? It's who's winning, right? The engineers or the managers? If mm-hmm. with your current understanding of the Boeing situation, how would you go in and like what would be the first thing you would do to try to like fix that culture?
I think you'd probably need to spend a few years just going around and trying to understand what's happening, because it's like I don't know how big Boeing is. Like Airbus is 150,000 people, and I mean, that's ridiculous. Like, how do you implement a culture at that scale? Like,
yeah,
I don't know. So, I guess you'd need to figure out what's happening. Like, so I don't think there's like a simple solution. No idea.
Yeah, I don't either. And especially, I would imagine, right? You just come in and you say, "Hey, listen, all middle managers, you're fired. Engineers, you need to think for yourself. We want to hear from the engineers. We don't want to hear from managers and board meetings." But it sounds like Boeing may have painted themselves in a corner by, you know, being so profit driven. And now you say, how do you go to your investors? How do you deal with the stock price falling and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. Whenever you say, "Hey, look, we're not going to worry about the bottom line so much. We're going to fix our engineering culture for the next 5 years." That sounds like a recipe for like almost bankruptcy or something like that. So it really should be like a warning to people. Hey, listen, you know, profit driven is great, but whenever you're in an industry like aerospace or aircrafts or anything like this, you have to listen to your engineers to a certain extent.
It's not even like profit driven, because if you look right now, like the financial results from Airbus are much better than Boeing. So it's not like you haven't achieved your desired financial outcome anyway. So, I mean, a big reason. So yeah, I used to work at Airbus and I didn't like it because it's just not what I'm good at. And I like, you know, with having like deep technical discussion about what the future looks like and like doing quick in iteration and like being comfortable with crashing and things and like figuring what is the next breakthrough or whatever. Like that's very different to the culture you want to have in an Airbus or a Boeing, where they're doing like small iterative improvements, but they need to do that in such a way where there's no room for failure. Like, so you need a very different culture, and a lot of it is being based on around processes and following those processes that have been set up and like understanding why they work well or whatever. And so I assume they must have all of that still working in Boeing. I mean, you know, even despite all the failures, it's still like, you know, it's not like every aircraft's crashing. Like there's still plenty of things that are right. So I don't think you need to like, you can't take drastic decision and like removing people and stuff. I think it's probably a long-term process, but, and especially as like what might be boring of like having good structure and everything is what makes it safe in the first place. So, I think it's hard to know without knowing the details of in those specific departments where they've had the issue, on like specifically the 737 MAX program, like were there things that were different between that program and another aircraft? Like, I don't know, but you need to know the details, I think.
I would love to be a fly on the wall, right? Just to be in there to see like, hey, what's going on? What are these board meetings like? You know, what are we talking about? What's our objective? What's our KPIs? All of this type of stuff. Because man, if I was running Boeing, I would shit myself if I cut a single dollar from our quality assurance budget, right?
Yeah, but I doubt that it's as simple as that. It might be like, you know, you create incentive for managers to behave in a specific way, which means later down the line, they've changed something and then like, you know, three layers down that you've had that impact. But to be fair, I don't know if that the top level they end up having those cutting those budgets. I mean, what's interesting though is that if you look at Airbus in particular, so if you were to buy from Airbus like the smaller airplane, like the A320, which is the equivalent of the 737 from Boeing, I don't know how much exactly the number now, but there's a massive there's a massive lead time. If you were to buy an aircraft today, maybe you get it in 5 years. I mean, don't quote me on the number, but it's pretty high. And the reason for it is there's way more demand than supply in like planes at the minute, especially on the smaller ones, which is where like Boeing is fucking up. So as a society, like the whole planet, we can't afford like Boeing to fuck up too much because there's only really two companies that are supplying the market. There are quite a lot of others that are doing it as well, but like they're really small comparatively. So everyone needs Boeing. Even Airbus, I think if Boeing was completely fucking up, they would be like, how can we scale up? Like we can't scale up. Like the main thing Airbus is struggling with is like, how can you increase like production for these aircraft, and demand for air travel is continuously going up. So it's an interesting situation, but it's not even like everyone is like, oh, this is so good for us. You know, we're going to make a good business because Boeing is not doing well. Everyone needs Boeing to sort it out.
Why do you think there isn't, where's the third competitor? Why is it only two?
Because it's very difficult, I think. Like the complexity, I think we get used to it of like, oh yeah, we just get in an airplane and it works. It's like, I mean, and we're like excited with like something new happening in AI where, you know, two people can do it and like you use some existing libraries and like, if you think about like building a plane company from scratch, is like, it's mind boggling. It's just, we forget about it because you're just so used to it. But the level of complexity and safety you need to have in place for these is just ridiculous. So it's just really hard. And so, I mean, the other companies that are doing it, there is one in Brazil called Embraer. There is one in China called Comac. So China has been investing massively in this for a very, very long time. And eventually they'll get there, but it's just, it takes forever. So that's why it's not easy. Super difficult.
Dang, man, it must be difficult because we've had like Boeing and Airbus for quite some time and nobody could break through. So credit to them. Whenever you talk about your own drones, why did you choose to go battery powered? Because batteries are incredibly heavy.
It's true. Like, I mean, it's not just the weight, it's like the specific energy. So it's like we get less energy for the same weight because ultimately we can't put more weight on the plane. Where did you go batteries? One is like fundamentally not wanting to use internal combustion, just like sustainability aspect. But actually the main reason is we're thinking about everything we do is for that longer term, like that, the way we believe longer term drones will be implemented. And if we say longer term, it is a robotic infrastructure where people occasionally go to those hangars to do a bit of maintenance and everything, but otherwise it just works by itself. because you want to take people in the, out of the loop completely. That's how you reduce the cost. In that scenario, you don't want internal combustion engine on those drones that need to be like frequently maintained, because if there's like internal combustion engine, it's pretty bad reliability. Also, what do you have, like a automatic like spot refueling on the drone or something? It's like, it doesn't feel like the future. The future is like batteries that get swapped, or maybe the drone lands and it just gets recharged. I think I can't imagine the future being internal combustion with like robotic nozzles coming and start refueling the drone. That sounds ridiculous.
How do you balance long-term future with short-term sustainability? Because a lot of companies, small companies, go bankrupt while thinking about the future 10 years from now.
Well, it's like balancing, you know, within the roadmap that you need for that future implementation, what are the things that make sense to do today technically, and what are the things that are going to be beneficial for customers today? And then you start with these ones and you try to minimize the amount of like side quests you need to go on to that maybe are necessary, but are like, you know, long-term, that side quest is not really beneficial. It's not like the main story, but you still need it. You're happy to take it because short-term you need it to sell to customers. So that sounds pretty simple, but yeah, I mean, for us, it's like, you know, specific features we focus on at first. So it was, for example, just doing the aircraft, not doing the robotic hangar and everything, because today it makes no sense, because you need a pilot on the ground from a regulatory standpoint. So if you need a pilot and you have a robotic hangar, you're going to have the robotic hangar, but you'll still have the pilot next to it. So you won't get the benefit of having a fully automated system because you still need someone next to it. So that's how you're trying to pick up what makes sense early on to develop. Yeah,
with the side missions. That's such a great way to put it, because I used to work for a very small company too. It was a startup, and our CEO would go out and they would meet with maybe a potential client. And our CEO would sell the client, say, hey, listen, do you want this? You want this? And he would sell the client on a feature that we didn't even build yet. It was just, he'd be like, yeah, man, hey, I just sold this. I made $35,000. We have to have this built by next week or the check is going to bounce, right? Is that the type of stuff you have to deal with?
I mean, you constantly have to sell what you're trying to build as a startup, because you have to paint that vision ultimately. And you have to balance that between, you have to balance selling that and what you have available today. Like, it's for sure. Yeah. Ultimately, especially for us, we're trying to sell big government contract. So it's not like, you know, I don't know what the product you were doing before, but let's say if you were selling to, you know, like to consumer or maybe to like small companies, there are billions of people. There's probably millions of small companies. So if you were to sell something that you can't deliver to someone and you fuck it up, then you're like, what? Okay, there's like a billion other potential customers or a million other potential. Who cares? For us, it's very different because the pool of, you know, governmental organization that need to do maritime monitoring for like fisheries protection or whatever, it's like a pretty small pool. So if we start fucking it up, it's we're done basically. So we have to be more careful about this. But because the industry is immature, most of these organizations will have seen other people selling them stuff before that didn't work. So by just having, you know, good communication where you say, look, guys, this is what we're building. Ultimately, this is what we want to sell to you. And sometimes we show renders and people are like, wow, we thought this was science fiction. So for example, you know, the robotic hangar I've talked about, we're talking about putting that on a vessel, but a robotic vessel. So it's kind of like a robotic aircraft carrier at that point. So you imagine a small robotic, like a 25 ton, so small-ish vessel, hydrogen powered, goes out in the Atlantic, and then you have the robotic hangar on it and it just flies the drone. So let's say. And sometimes we show these vision to those people and they're like, we're clear that this is not what we have now, but we're going to have that in, you know, a year and a half. And you can use that narrative to get them involved in the product we have today. So I think it's possible to navigate between the two. But
okay. That was a key distinction. I really didn't. And you're so right. And you nailed it, right? Whenever you do have a very small client pool, you can't always be flying by the seat of your pants. You know, you have to make sure because... Mm-hmm. You know, it's a small group of people, and I'm sure they talk, right? And be like, hey, this guy, Matt, his company sucks. You know, his drone crashed, and next thing you know, your reputation is ruined. Whenever you talk about the decision to go with batteries, we know that batteries do not like cold weather. Does that limit your ability and your range in cold weather?
No, that's definitely something. Interestingly, most of our operation right now have been like in Africa, in Southern America, in Central America, and Caribbean. So it's all been like actually really warm weather. We haven't even done the math of how it affects us, but for sure it would affect us. There's plenty of other drone manufacturers that have solved this by having, you know, some heating of the batteries. We do have quite a lot of like excess heat on the plane when we're flying, like the motors generate, like, you know, based on the, like a motor might be like 90% efficient, still means like 10% of the energy you produce, like you're using is gets out in heat. So there must be there's probably a good way to like heat up the battery, but for sure it'd affect us. I was just thinking another thing on what we were talking about earlier, the, like, you know, the, how do you manage the, like being ambitious and like selling the next thing when you, but at the same time, you know, you need to be able to deliver that next thing. And it's hard to know in advance how reliably you're going to be able to deliver what you think you're going to be able to build.
Yeah.
I think it's also important to be kind of ambitious and like really pushing yourself and telling to a customer, we're going to have this. Cause then if you do that, you have a legitimate deadline for in the company that motivates yourself to try to hit something. Because if you don't set that kind of like, it's like you set an external constraint. So like a customer, you've sold something to a customer. So now it's not just internally you're saying, oh, we should have that feature by then because we want it and that's our objective. Now you've said, oh, we've sold that to this guy, so we need to have it by then. It makes it way more compelling to like work crazy hard and like be super motivated. So I think you work as a company, you're more effective, and it's just also way more fun. Like you're more motivated to work towards something when you've committed to someone externally. So that's also an important factor to consider. I mean, I don't know how it was when you talked about your company, when your CEO might come back and say, well, I've just $35K for this feature. We need it next week. I mean, if it's next week, maybe it's not super beneficial, but was it motivational sometime to have like a crazy deadline or?
It was always.
Like, oh, fuck that.
It was just another. Yeah, I'm getting paid anyway. Fuck it. No, and you probably know this. Whenever you work at a startup, it takes like a different type of person. If you want to punch the clock, go home to your wife, watch TV, that's maybe a startup's not your jam. It was totally my jam. Oh my gosh, I loved it. Like my favorite days working at this startup was like the days where I would stay up till 12 p.m. or 12 a.m. in the morning just coding because it's like, I have to get this done. It was extremely motivative. And so like the CEO would come in and, you know, we had like 10 people in the company, right? And he would gather everyone around and he would say, hey, listen, I just talked to Leica or whatever. It was a sensor company. And we just sold this feature. We need to have this new mapping feature UI, and they're going to have these types of sensors overlaid on it. And he would just give us details, and maybe we would stew on it for an hour. And then all the technical people would come be like, how can we make this happen? And it was like, it was very, it was like almost, it's kind of like whenever you talk to people in the military and you say, hey, what was the best time of your life? It was like the time I was at war. It's like, that makes no sense. You're about to die. But the time that I would work like 14, 15 hours a day were my favorite times. I love that shit. Oh man, challenge me because I want to see, like, I want the target and I want to try my best to hit it, and I will do it at all costs. And if I fail, I may cry. But if we succeeded, which we did most of the time, we would always celebrate afterwards. And it was working at a startup for me more felt like just hanging out with buddies in a garage than it did working for a company. And I love that.
Yeah. No, I think it's like, it gives you that sense of purpose, like very clear, because if someone buys a feature you haven't built yet, it means like, you know, they actually want it. So it's like, what I'm doing is genuinely useful. And also when you're in a startup, like you said, you know, 10 people, we're also really small at the minute. It's, you have a direct connection to that deliverable. It's not like when you're a bigger company, like you're in Airbus, you're one person in 150,000, you know, it's hard to see how what you're doing is contributing to anyone. So those two things of like, you know, it's going to be helpful to someone who has paid for it, and you yourself have a very tangible impact. I think those two things, makes it super exciting.
Yeah, super exciting. And also the culture at a startup, you just kind of do whatever the fuck you want. Like in a lot of big companies, you know, you kind of have like these handcuffs where like these managers, hey, you can't touch this, don't do that. At a startup, it's like, we need this, and I don't really care how you get it done. We just need it done, right? Obviously, you don't want to be unethical, right? You don't want to like write software with no tests, or you don't want to like do things like cut corners, but you could do anything. Listen, if you want to go work on the rooftop and that's your jam, go do it. If you want to like use some like different library or whatever. You don't need management approval. It just feels like really, really natural to me. Did you enjoy working at a big company?
No, not really. I think it's, I mean, I think it was super valuable for two reasons. One was, you know, when you, it's useful to have like a stamp of approval, that it, like an external validation of your skills, when you're building a company, especially early on. So having work at Airbus, which is still like in Europe, you know, that's the biggest like aircraft manufacturer, kind of difficult to get a job there. So it was positive to have worked there from that stamp of approval, even though I don't think I learned that much. The other thing that was useful is the one I actually went to Airbus for one very specific job. I just didn't want to be specifically in Airbus. I wanted to be in one department, which is called Future Projects. So that's, I don't know if you know the Skunk Works in like, you know, Lockheed Martin, it's like the term Skunk Works. And so it's kind of like the equivalent. It's like the secretive department that does, you know, the cool aircraft concept that Airbus might do 20 or 30 years from now or might not. But, you know, they have to constantly figure out what could be done, because if Boeing does something, you know, we need to be able to like quickly respond to it. So you look at the coolest kind of concept. And it's also typically the most passionate people in the company because they're like into that stuff. So I always wanted to get that job, but it's very hard to get because it's like maybe 20 people, you know, out of the 150,000. And a lot of people want that job because it's a cool one. So, what I learned was one, like having the what was valuable is one, the stamp of approval. And two, because I wanted that job, I had to try to get it. I applied 10 times. And I kept getting rejected. So it like really taught me like, you know, resilience and just keep going at it. And like, you know, I didn't care if I was being rejected. You know, you tend to, you just assume, well, I'm not good enough, right? If you get rejected. So it's like, how do you fight against this and be like, no, it's not that I'm just going to work harder next time and do it again. And you do that like 10 times in a row. I think those skills are very transferable to building a business because constant, like, you know, it doesn't work. Like the only way it works in a business is you're constantly hitting your head against like problems and you keep going anyway. So, so those two, even though I didn't like working in a big company because it's not for me, that's just not my personality. It was super useful. I think it was completely essential to what I'm doing now.
Yeah. Big companies are cool. There are some things you can learn and see kind of like how they operate and why they operate that way. For your company, Marble, what do you think your company looks like 5 years from now, assuming that you are successful?
I mean, I told you like the vision of where I think drones are going to be. So I think we're going to be like one of the big companies that implement, like one of the companies that makes that happen. So that vision is having networks of robotic hangars deployed mostly on coast. If you're talking 5 years from now, later on, we'll just be everywhere. So along most coast on the planet, you'll have a robotic hangar maybe every 150 kilometers. Each of them will have, you know, three aircraft operated from. Each of them will just have like, you know, Starlink or an equivalent straight from it. So they will be collecting data and in real time across the whole world on all these coasts, it'll be aggregated in one location. Anyone can get access to that. Just you pay for the data that you consume. You can also task the drone compared to a satellite. You could actually say, you know, in 5 minutes, I want this data over here. And you could actually just get that. You can't really do that with a satellite. So we will be the company supplying that. We'll have built the hardware and we'll be selling that data as a service. There'll probably be a lot of additional layer of intelligence on top. We touched a little bit on like artificial intelligence, computer vision. So 5 years from now, and we'll probably have some of these not just on the coast, but also on vessels across the, you know, a bit further out when you want data, not just like, you know, on the coast, but like halfway across the Atlantic.
I think I am going to buy lots of your data and I'm going to try to find the Loch Ness Monster and I'm going to be very famous after I do that. Matt, thank you so much for coming on the pod. How can people find out more about you and your company?
Is just our website. So it's marble.aero. Just on LinkedIn, that's probably where I'm most active. And if you want to get in touch, it's contact@marble.aero.
Awesome. Once again, thank you so much for coming on, Matt. You're super smart. I can tell every single opinion you have, you spent many hours thinking about it, and I always appreciate that, man. Thanks.
Thanks. It was great to have a chat with you.